We're glad for the opportunity to be here with you tonight. And over the years, I've had discussions with various people on this subject and have actually presented some of it in a series that I did on how to study the Bible. I think we were here a number of years ago and did the study on how to study the Bible. And so a few points of this were mentioned, and that's how this request came. So tonight we're going to spend time looking at this big controversy regarding which is the best English version. And just remember that the basic belief we have here is that God has given us the Bible. It is not man's word. Man did not originate this. It's God's word. 2 Timothy 3:16 says the word of God is God-breathed. Now, we do not have what is called the autographs of any biblical book. The autograph means the first epistle as Paul wrote it. That piece of papyrus that he wrote it on, we do not have that. We don't have that for any biblical book. The nearest thing we have is handwritten copies of copies of copies. Now, the area of controversy involves this. Some people say, well, the newer translations, newer than the King James, leave out verses or phrases. Now, the question is, who makes this charge? That's a serious charge. Who makes the charge? Basically, the people who make that charge are people who want to prove that the King James Version is superior to other versions. They assume that the King James Version is perfect, and any deviation from it is error. See, that's all tied up in this assumption. Now, which is worse? Is it worse to leave out a phrase or verse of Scripture, or is it worse to add in one that wasn't there in the first place? Which is worse? In other words, they're the same. They're equally wrong. You shouldn't add to it. You shouldn't take away. And so, really, what you have to determine is, was this given controversial place a place that was taken away, or was it a place that was added in? And you cannot, ahead of time, assume the answer and then use that to prove other things. The fact is, most modern translations are translating from a different set of Greek manuscripts than what was used for the King James Version. So what we have to do is consider this issue, and that is which manuscripts are closer to the original. Now, the fact that some translations omit or include certain portions does not mean that those translators were trying to corrupt the text. We have to be fair about that. Many times that kind of accusation will be made where people will claim, all these modern people, they're just trying to ruin the text. They're taking the blood out of the Bible. They're doing this, they're doing that. We've got to be fair when we talk about this subject. In fact, some people say, well, the newer translations leave out the blood of Christ in some verses. The answer is, it depends on which manuscript you are translating from. And besides, let's just assume this accusation has legitimacy. Let's assume that modern translators, there was a deliberate attempt to leave out the blood of Christ. They certainly did a shoddy job of it. I mean, if you really wanted to leave out the blood of Christ in the New Testament, you would have done it much more thoroughly than the modern versions have done it. You see, that accusation doesn't carry weight, because anybody that was thinking at all and wanting to cut out the blood of Christ from the translation would have done it much more thoroughly. Now the question is, which manuscript evidence do we use? There are two basic approaches to which text to translate from. One is, go by the oldest manuscripts whenever you can, because they are closer in time to the original, and there's less opportunity for errors to creep in as copy after copy is made. Or the other main approach is to go by the majority of manuscripts, and the argument is that God has providentially preserved them for us, And since the majority of Greek manuscripts in existence today, we call that extant manuscripts, the ones that we know about. You know, there might be 500 that we don't even know about, buried somewhere or hidden in some closet. But the majority of Greek manuscripts that are extant are called Byzantine readings. Now, there are over 5,000 Byzantine texts compared to a much smaller number of Western or Alexandrian texts. What I'd like you to see is that, again, this argument is not going to work very well. Because you see, some people say, well, God preserved all of these texts, and so it must be, since they're in the majority, that is the real answer, and these other texts are deficient and weren't used much, and so they shouldn't be translated from. But the fact is that there is no extant manuscript of the Byzantine text before the 4th century. In other words, we don't have any record of any at all. The majority did not occur in the 4th century, or the 2nd century, or the 1st century, or the 3rd century. It didn't occur there. In other words, it wasn't the majority in the 1st century, or the 2nd, or the 3rd, or the 4th, or the 5th. About the 9th century, you have a whole bunch of monks in monasteries making copies of Scripture. And what are they copying? They're copying what they have. You don't copy what you don't have. I mean, suppose, for example, we made 20 million copies of the NIV right now. Would that mean the NIV is superior to all other copies since it has the most? What's the answer? It would not. And so you see the argument about God preserved His Word and you have more copies of it than you have of the other ancient manuscripts proves nothing at all, because it didn't have a majority in the early centuries. In fact, not only that, the oldest translations of the New Testament, the first 3 centuries, the Old Latin, the Coptic, the earliest Syriac, were either translated from Alexandrian or Western texts. In other words, they were translated from texts that were not the majority text family. And there's only one, Syriac Peshitta, that some people claim to be Byzantine and early, but it's not the earliest form of Syriac. And the textual affinity isn't really clear. So the implication is this. These translations that were made very early in church history are based on what the King James Only group would call polluted texts. That means that many, many people in the 1st century, 2nd century, 3rd century were reading Bibles that, according to the King James Only movement, would be polluted Bibles. And by the way, I'm using the kind of terminology that strong King James Only advocates use when I say that. That's a very negative implication about God preserving His Word for His people. In fact, one of the arguments that King James Only people use is they will say, well, God preserved His Word for His people. You mean it took Him 1,500 years to get to the text that was the right one? Because there were millions of people that lived in earlier centuries that had no access to the Greek texts that the King James is based on. Furthermore, just in that vein, in the last 150 years, the vast majority of Bible translations made in the world are not made from the majority or Textus Receptus texts. They're made from what is called the eclectic text, which says, go back to the earliest manuscripts you can find. Where possible, they should have preeminence, but they don't require to be preeminent always if it's clear that that shouldn't be the case. And so the argument doesn't work, because didn't God care about the millions of people in Africa and in Asia that have gotten translations that are based on a different text than what the King James is based on? Furthermore, if these versions in the early centuries, first 3 centuries, originated from a supposed polluted text, you would expect those early versions to come from one region and be used in that region, but that's not the case. Those early versions came from all over the Mediterranean, and they are not Byzantine in character. Now, Byzantine is another name that's used when they're discussing the majority text. Now, even if you could prove that there was one text that exists in, say, 1st or 2nd century that was of the majority text family, that would not prove that that text was a majority in that century. It would just show that there was just one. The fact is, no one can show us any Byzantine or majority text that is older than 4th century. And the conclusion you come to, if you look at this in a careful manner, is that the evidence is the Byzantine text did not exist before the 4th century. Now, as I think of some of the arguments that come up, I'll mention them. Some people say, well, what happened was the Byzantine text was the right one. And so people used that till it wore out. Okay, the question is, the question is, did the King James come from the Byzantine text? Yes, in a sense it did. Now I'll explain how that is. The King James was translated from something called the Textus Receptus, which is not a text at all. In other words, there's no manuscript called the Textus Receptus. Erasmus compiled out of about 4 or so manuscripts the document that is called the Textus Receptus. The manuscripts that he had available to him were Byzantine texts. And so the Textus Receptus is a successor to the Byzantine line. And that's what we call the majority text, because the majority text is not the Textus Receptus. It's the majority of texts that exist there are the Byzantine family that goes back to about the 4th century. So what we have is that the Byzantine text, to all the evidence we have, did not exist before the 4th century. We have no extant copy of it. And the translations that were translated earlier than that can clearly be shown to have originated as being translated from Western or Alexandrian texts. Now, it's always possible to invent explanations to account for a theory that fails. I think one of the things we need to watch out for in church life is to, when someone says something, say, you need to demonstrate the truth of that statement. And then if they say a paragraph that supposedly eases in on it, make sure that that paragraph is not just an assertion, but is actually a proof. And so many times what people will do, they have a theory that they want to hold, and then you show them it doesn't work, then they invent some other point to make it look like it would be credible. Now, we were talking a little bit about manuscripts that are used a lot being worn out. And so you see, one of the arguments is, well, the right manuscripts were so good, and people used them until they fell apart, and so they weren't saved, they just made a new copy of it, but they used it until it just completely wore out. Now, let me ask you, how many of you have more than 5 copies of the Bible in your house? Probably most of you do. Do you have any of those that are at least 20 years old? How many have copies that are 20 years old? The ones that you have copies of 20 years old, are you using those? How many of you are using those 20-year-old copies? Hardly anybody, maybe one person. Why is that? Why don't you use them till they're wore out? Do you see what I'm getting at? I think people have a reluctance to throw away the Bible, even if the pages are so loose and crumbly. You know, as paper, in paper, it ages, it has an acidic character, and the pages get brittle, and so they begin to break apart, but you don't really quite want to throw away the Bible. So I don't even think that argument works. But anyhow, the argument is merely a theory. They haven't proven at all that people took the best manuscripts and used them until they totally wore out, and then they used new copies, and so that's why we don't have any. See, that's the kind of theories people make up to hold their position. Now, the King James Version is based on the Textus Receptus, and like I mentioned, the Textus Receptus is not a manuscript. It is a compilation of several manuscripts. It was compiled by a man named Erasmus in the 1500s, and he had only a few Greek manuscripts to check. And these manuscripts were of the Byzantine type, namely what we call now the majority text. So naturally, he used what he had. And using what you have is much better than not using what you don't have. I mean, you know, the King James Version has blessed many, many people for hundreds of years. And that's been good. But the Textus Receptus did not exist before 1500. Furthermore, the Textus Receptus has errors in it. And it can easily be demonstrated. The Textus Receptus differs from the Byzantine text in nearly 2,000 places. Now, a lot of those places are not going to be significant. Maybe it'd be a misspelling of a word or something like that. But nevertheless, it is not identical. Erasmus was in a big hurry. He wanted to be the first one to bring out a printed edition of the Greek New Testament. What happens if you're doing a tedious job in a big hurry? Mistakes are made. And so there are many errors in it. In fact, there are some specific errors that aren't necessarily what you would call hurried errors. For example, Revelation 22, verses 18 and 19, it says that whoever takes away from the prophecy of this book, God will take away what? Anybody remember? Take away his portion from the book of life or name from the book of life. I can't remember the exact wording there. His part, that's it. His part from the book of life. There is no extant Greek manuscript, none. Not a majority manuscript, not an eclectic manuscript. There is no extant Greek manuscript that says that. The Greek says tree. And if you people read German and read what the German says, you'll find the German says tree. So that obviously raises the question, who was right, Luther or King James? Now, if you're an honest translator, you have to admit that if you have no Greek manuscripts whatsoever that say book, and all of them that you've got say tree, you say, where'd that come from? And the answer is an interesting story. The manuscript that Erasmus had for the book of Revelation didn't have the last page.
Read it how it should be, how you're saying it.
Okay. Turn to Revelation 22:19. And if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part from the... And some manuscript, some translations, namely King James, New King James, says book of life. Whereas all of the extant Greek manuscripts say tree of life. Okay? So the way this happened was Erasmus did not have a Greek manuscript with the last page of Revelation in it. And he was a very smart scholar, very skillful, and so he just took the Latin Vulgate, which is the translation, and back-translated into Greek from the Latin and put that in there. And that's how book of life came instead of tree of life. And when Martin Luther translated it, he realized it should be tree of life, and that's what he put in German. 1 John 5, 7b through 8a, the majority manuscripts and the eclectic or Western manuscripts omit this. There are only a few very late manuscripts that have that portion in there. You know that thing about the spirit and water giving witness? Let me just turn to that. 1 John 5:7. For there are three that bear witness. And then in the New King James helps us out a lot because it gives a footnote that helps you see some of these things just from English. And there's a footnote right there before in heaven and says, in you and M, that would be the eclectic text and the majority manuscripts, omit the words from in heaven, verse 7, through on earth, verse 8. Only four or five very late manuscripts contain these words in Greek. Now the story is that Erasmus did not believe that those words were part of the legitimate text. But Erasmus was one who wanted the the authorization by the Pope. And so he told his Catholic boss he was not going to put that in there. But his Catholic bosses wanted it put in. And he said, show me a manuscript with it in and I'll put it in. Well, guess what? Several of these manuscripts that have it in, it's written in the margin in a different hand than the original. So you can do with it what you want. But if you're an honest translator and you're spending your life translating the Bible, and by the way, translation has been a big subject with our family for many years. Our oldest daughter is 42 at the present time, and I tutored her in New Testament Greek when she was about 10 years old. And so we've had discussions on translation for many years when she was a child. And then she went to Africa in 1997 as a Bible translator in Nigeria, and she's been there ever since. So we have lots of discussion over translation issues for a long time. And if you're an honest translator and you devote your life into translating the scripture for people that don't have it in their own language, you want to be translating the right thing. If you have all these manuscripts that have the part omitted there in 1 John 5, verses 7 and 8, and then you have only a few very late ones that have it in and it's written in the margin, as an honest translator, what are you going to do? You have to make a decision. You can't just say, well, I'm just not going to make a decision, because either you're going to put it in or you're not going to put it in. And what I'm saying is, when you look at the evidence, the honest translator is going to have to say, I don't think it should go in there. We have to follow the evidence. And so, you see, it's a false claim to say the King James Version is perfect and without error, and that all deviations from it are errors. Now, that leaves us with this. You have the King James Version that is translated from the Textus Receptus, and it's very clear that Textus Receptus has errors in it. That's easy to demonstrate. And I've given you a couple places, for example, in Revelation and in 1 John. And so that leaves us, really, in honest inquiry, with only two basic choices, either to have the majority text or the eclectic text. The majority text says, the majority of manuscripts say this, so we will go with that. The eclectic text says, we look at all of the manuscripts and we give some preference to older ones because it's less likely that copying errors would have sprung in. But it's not that they insist that we always take the oldest, because sometimes there's internal evidence that would suggest an older copy isn't as good as maybe a later copy. So, let's suppose you say the majority text should be the one. The problem you have is the majority text is not uniform. It's not that there's 5,000 copies all exactly the same of the majority text. There's variation among them. So you're going to have to do the exact same thing that people do when they look at all the texts. You're going to have to evaluate, is this reading better or is this reading better? Is this reading more accurate or is that one? And so you're going to have to engage in textual criticism and analysis to see which text is best. And I believe that the eclectic text, they do textual criticism as well. They prefer the older manuscripts, but they recognize that the oldest is not necessarily the best. And so the oldest is not blindly followed. And so the eclectic text actually evaluates all the evidence, whereas the people who insist on the majority text are absolutely refusing some of the evidence and just making a claim that it's corrupt. So what do we do? This is a question. Is the King James Version an evil version? And my answer is absolutely not. Did we get that straight? Absolutely not. It is not an evil version. It has blessed millions of people for hundreds of years. But we have to reckon and be honest with the fact that there are some fallacies due to the King James Version. There are fallacies that people believe because they simply read the King James Version and don't read other versions. For example, Acts 28, verse 13. And from thence we fetched a compass and came to Regium. And after one day the south wind blew, and we came the next day to Puteoli. What did they fetch? Anybody know? I'm reading a quote from the King James. Yeah, they fetched a compass. So what does that mean? What was it that they fetched? A little round circular instrument that told them what?
North and south.
Which direction it was? What's the problem here? That's right. The compass was not invented until just a few hundred years ago, or maybe just a couple hundred. I don't remember what the number is, but I'll guarantee you Paul didn't have one, and none of his sailor friends had one either. What it really means is they went in a circular route. But now you see, the word compass doesn't convey that in English, and so many people, they just think, oh, I guess they fetched a compass. That's a faulty understanding, a false understanding based on obsolete English. Acts 19, verse 9a. But when divers were hardened and believed not, but spake evil of that way before the multitude, he departed from them. When what were hardened? Divers. That's strange, isn't it? So divers get hardened. What about runners? What about people that are farmers? But just if you're a diver, you get hardened. You see, in our language that is used today, if you gave that Bible to a person who was non-churched, they would say, divers got hardened. Well, they aren't even at the sea. What's going on there? It would be confusing. Because that word is a legitimate English word today, and the meaning today, not one out of 100 people in America that aren't churched would think of when various ones were hardened. How about James chapter 2, verse 3? And ye have respect to him that weareth the gay clothing, and say to him, sit thou here in a good place, and say to the poor, stand there, or sit under my footstool. Respect for the person who wears the gay clothing? That would be an interesting one too. Not only that, there's missing impact due to obscure translation. Luke 21, verse 9. This is talking about future things, and it says this, but when ye shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. What does that last phrase mean? But the end is not by and by. Anybody here know?
God says it's not. It's a long way off.
Okay, but you see what I'm saying? People are guessing. If you read it in Greek, it's the end is not yet. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Verse 12. You know, I often read from the New King James Version without explicitly saying so, and I don't make an issue of it. But it's near enough to the King James that people who are following the King James can follow along. And then sometimes they receive clarity as I'm preaching because I'm reading something that is clear for them to understand without me making a big issue of it. But then sometimes someone will meet me at the back and think that their mission in life is to convert me to the right version. So this is one of the texts that I use when I meet such a person. I say, what does 2 Corinthians 6 verse 12 mean? Well, they don't necessarily remember the verse, and I don't object to that. So they turn to it, and they glance at it, and they say, well, I've got to look at the context. And I say, well, sure, I'm all in favor of that. Go ahead, look at the context. They look at the context, and they still can't tell me what it means, unless they have studied it in another version or looked up a whole bunch of things. Here's what it says. Ye are not straitened in us, but ye are straitened in your own bowels. Now imagine that reading that to someone in prison who's never been to church. In a similar vein, Philemon verse 7 says, for we have great joy and consolation in thy love because the bowels of the saints are refreshed by thee, brother. It's an opportunity for great misunderstanding and for misunderstanding by your children who are listening in the congregation when such passages are read. Here's another one. 2 Corinthians 8, verse 1. Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia. We do you to wit. What does that mean? Here's another one. I'd like you to turn to Colossians chapter 2, verse 23. King James says this, which things have indeed a show of wisdom in will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh. Who here would like to explain what that means? I can ask almost anybody who's a habitual reader of the King James Version what that verse means, and they do not know. Now let me read it from the New King James. These things, and he's talking about these things of touch not, taste not, handle not, making all these commandments, etc. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. That is a very important verse for understanding that making rules for yourself might look like it's great, but it has no real value because it won't stop the flesh from just going on and doing what it wants. Sometimes there's a false conclusion that's based on a specific translation. I know of a situation where a preacher said about Romans 6, verse 2, where it says, God forbid, you know, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid! And he said, that's the strongest negative expression in the entire Bible. Actually, he was making a totally false point because no extant Greek manuscript that we know of contains this expression. None. In Greek, it is megnoito, and that simply means may it never be. Now, let's just turn that around. What if the NIV had said, God forbid, and the King James had said, may it never be? What would the King James only advocates say about the NIV? They're making the Bible swear. You see, a lot of the arguments that King James only people use against other translations, if they applied them to the King James itself, they would discredit the King James. By the way, I'm mentioning the NIV. I'm not saying that I am a great advocate of the NIV. I think they did liberties with the text they should not have done. But the point I'm making is it's one of the versions that comes under attack. There's another fallacy, a misconception due to translation into a common English word. Philippians 4, verse 5 in the King James says, let your moderation be known to all men. Moderation is obviously a current English word that is in common use. But the King James translated the Greek word moderation. That root word occurs 5 times in the New Testament. And every other time, the King James translates it with the idea of patient or gentle, etc. It doesn't use the word moderation. I have no idea why in this case they used the word moderation. How many of you have ever heard this text as the foundational text of a sermon on moderation? Anybody? I have. That was the first text. You know, that's the foundational one. Doesn't work. 1 Samuel 27, verse 10. The King James reads, whither have ye made a road today? It's King Achish talking to David. Was David a road construction worker? What does it mean when it says, whither have ye made a road today? Any ideas? It's really the whole idea of they were going on a raid. In other words, David would go out and make a raid somewhere. It's not talking about making roads. James 5:11. What would the modern reader think? Behold, we count them happy which endure. You have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. What does it mean to say the Lord is pitiful? Not in modern English. What does it mean? If I would say you are pitiful, what would that mean? It would mean that you deserve to be pitied. That's what it would mean in modern English. And so the modern English reader, if he hasn't been versed in this whole thing, would never get the right impression of God reading that verse. Many times the King James Version, you will have familiarity without understanding. Titus chapter 2, verse 10 says this. It's talking about servants. And it says, not purloining, but showing all good fidelity, that they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior in all things. What does purloining mean? Okay? It does. It means petty thievery. But you know, I've talked to people, I remember talking to an elder in a church who preferred the King James, but he read some other versions. And he said, I looked that up once, but I can't remember what it was. Why is that? Because that's not language we use. That's why. My guess is if you had take a survey of children who grow up in a King James only type environment of church and asked them what that word means, the children under 12 wouldn't know what it means, but they will know they've heard it in the service. You see, that word is not a word that is used today regarding petty thievery. How about this one? You can get a bizarre portrait of God who is spirit. Isaiah 63, verse 15. Look down from heaven and behold from the habitation of thy holiness and of thy glory. Where is thy zeal and thy strength? The sounding of thy bowels and of thy mercies toward me. Are they restrained? Now remember, God is a spirit and it's talking about the sounding of his bowels. I'm just saying, if you take this and use this text as it is to people who are walking the streets of our country, it will be confusing to them. There are some places where the King James Version is actually inaccurate. Let me give you an example. 2 Timothy 2, verse 12. It says, if we suffer, we shall also reign with him. Now, the Greek text is identical for the eclectic text and for the Textus Receptus. And the Greek text says, we endure. Think about this. The King James Version is clearly a different idea. The King James says, if we suffer, we shall also reign. And the Greek texts say, if we endure, we shall reign. Now, from what you know about theology, don't worry about manuscripts here for a moment, but from what you know about theology, which one of those statements would be more correct? If we suffer, we'll reign, or if we endure, we'll reign? Endure. There's going to be plenty of people who suffered and they aren't going to reign. But it's only those who endure in the things of God that are going to reign. See? And what I'm saying is, the Greek text indicates endure, and somehow the King James Version says suffer. And the fact of the matter is, the Textus Receptus itself, which the King James is based on, says endure. Luke 18, verse 12. The Pharisee is talking. You know, the Pharisee and the publican went up to pray. And he's talking to God. And he says, I give tithes of all I possess. What does that mean? He says, I give tithes of all I possess. That would mean, literally, that everything he owns, he gives a tithe of it. And the next week, everything he owns, he gives a tithe of it. And the next week, everything he owns, he gives a tithe of it. That is exactly what it says. That's not what the Greek says. The Greek says, I give tithes of all I acquire. Which really makes much more sense. Mark 6, verse 20. It says there that, and I should read that text, that has to do with Herod and John the Baptist. It says, Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. That's the New King James. But the King James Version, which I need to look up here because I didn't have that right in front of me. Hang on a second. It said, the King James Version says, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy, he was a just man and holy, and observed him. You see, that's a very strange rendering there. He feared God and observed him. And what it should be saying is, the Greek word means protected. Modern versions get it right. James chapter 3, verse 2 says that, it says in the King James Version, in many things we offend all. Do you really believe that? In many things we offend everybody? Modern versions say, we all stumble in many ways. See? The English rendering, in many things we offend all, would mean We offend everybody. Another problem with the King James Version is there is loss of impact. Some years ago, we were at a church where the elder was very much a promoter of the King James, and he asked my wife a question about her role as a mother. Just to give you a little background, we've had children living in dangerous places. Our daughter is a Bible translator in Nigeria, and we had a second daughter that went over there to do literacy work. And a month or so after she got there, these two daughters were in an armed robbery where someone pulled in front of their vehicle right in the middle of broad daylight in a village. They stopped with the motor running to buy some food out the window. And these guys pulled up in front until they couldn't move, got guns and were firing shots and said, "Lay on the ground." So that's just an example. And this leader said to Rhoda, "How can you as a mother cope with the fact that you have children in these dangerous places?" And she said, "You know, the Lord has really encouraged me by a verse in the Psalms. It says, 'To God the Lord belong escapes from death.'" He said, "Where is that?" She said, "Psalm 68:20." So he opened up his King James Version to read it. And he found this: "Unto God the Lord belong the issues from death." Do you see why he was never impacted by that verse? To God the Lord belong the issues from death. What does that mean? But when my wife read, "To God the Lord belong the escapes from death," then it was a great comfort to her. Now, in light of all these things, is the King James Version the best English translation available today? And I think the answer is no. Is the King James Version understandable? In many places, yes, it is. But in many other places, it is confusing, especially to the unchurched. And many people do not realize how poorly they understand the King James Version because they love what is familiar. They say, "I like the cadence of the language." But then even if they check on the meaning, they often quickly forget it because the King James wording is something not used in our current English. And furthermore, this is not just a neutral subject because the King James Version repeatedly read to children will impart the wording to the children without the understanding. Now often people who are preaching and use the King James Version recognize this problem, so they explain what it means. So they might say, "Well, you know, this verse that says something about our conversation, that doesn't mean conversation the way we mean. It means your way of life. So when you see conversation, that means your way of life." What are they doing? Their explanation corresponds to the modern translations, not to the King James. It corresponds to the modern translations, which they tend to regard as corrupt. And so they're giving an explanation that agrees with the modern translations instead of the one they're actually using. Why not use a text that people understand in the first place? I'll give you an example. I grew up with the King James Version. I memorized big blocks of it. And my mother, of course, grew up with the King James Version. And at one point, when she was in her 50s, someone gave her an NIV. And she said, "You know, I would read a verse in this NIV, and I'm amazed. Is that what the verse means?" Then I'd go check the King James. I'm like, "Oh yeah, that is what it means." You see what's happening? She understood things that she had never really understood, but it was familiar and she'd read over it. And then when the NIV said it in a way that was in her mother tongue, namely her current usage, it was like, "Oh, so that's what it means." Now let me comment about some modern translations. There is one type of translational philosophy called dynamic equivalent. The NIV uses this kind. It's saying what you do is you put it in words that are dynamically equivalent to what is being said. You don't worry about literal translation. Now, that doesn't mean the NIV is not literal in some places. Some places it is. But I'm just saying that's a basic philosophy. And some people might say, "Well, the King James is translated literally." There are some places it's not, because it would be impossible to translate literally. Let me give you an example. You remember when Jonah was complaining to God about how he didn't want to go to Nineveh, you know, and he wanted the Ninevites destroyed, and you know, God's going to have mercy on him. He's afraid they're going to have mercy. He's going to have mercy on them. And so he says, God, I know that you are long-suffering and slow to anger, and that's why I didn't want this to happen. The Hebrews believed that anger came out the nose. And so if they wanted to describe someone who was slow to anger, they described him as having a very long nose, and it took a long time for that anger to come out. And so they would use that as a picture. So literally in Hebrew, it says, I knew you were a long-nosed God. In other words, I knew you were long-nosed. That's what it says. Now, can you imagine translating that literally for English speakers? And so, you know, I know that you're this kind of God and this kind, this God, and long-nosed. What would English speakers think? It's like, what is that? Rightfully so. You see, that's an illustration where you have to translate not literally, but actually dynamically equivalent, namely, where you are giving the idea that's behind that. Then there's another kind of book that's called a paraphrase. For example, Living Bible is like this. It is not attempting to be a translation per se, but it's just saying, I'll say this in other words. And so sometimes it might be very close to a translation, but it's not even attempting to be a translation. So I'm not saying it's wrong to read those, but I choose to base my study on something else. There's also something which I call a dishonest translation. An example of this is the Message by Peterson. There are times, if you go through that text, you'll see he put down what he felt like, and it's not even in the text. He put it in there. If you check the Greek or Hebrew, it's not there. And then there are the ones that are quite literal would be the King James Version, the New King James, the English Standard Version, the ESV, or the New American Standard. And I prefer a more literal translations because they come closer to the original wording. But I prefer not the King James because of the difficulties I've mentioned. In fact, I've challenged people already. If you're accustomed to using the King James, do this in private. Have your entire devotions for 1 year in one of these versions, New King James, ESV, or New American Standard. And I guarantee you will have your mind open to vistas of understanding of the Bible that you do not have right now. It will happen. That happens to people. When they try it, that happens to them. Because suddenly they're impacted by verses that they just sloughed over. It just went, tew, tew, tew. They didn't notice the impact. So what about all this controversy? I believe it's important to notice this. The Bible says, by their fruit you shall know them. In other words, it's talking about teachers who are false and teachers who are true. By their fruit you shall know them. And the people who are strong King James-only advocates, they often use accusatory language against others. They will say, these modern translators were conspirators, they were trying to corrupt the Bible, they were doing this and they were doing that. They defame other people's character. They claim that other versions are products of the devil. I remember someone brought an article out, and they were talking about the New King James, and they said it has the title of the article was The Hiss of the Serpent. You know, those are serious, serious charges. Very ungodly. Very serious. It's interesting that people who use other versions don't say that kind of stuff about the King James or about the people who have translated the King James. Furthermore, most people do not know the history of the King James only movement. It's a recent doctrine of church history. It's less than 100 years old. It began with a book written by a Seventh-day Adventist, and that book was not well received. And then a man named David Otis Fuller and others plagiarized this book, in other words, took pieces out of it, and printed it up and didn't tell the source. If they had told the source and said the source of these quotes were from this Seventh-day Adventist, probably it wouldn't have got off the ground. And the vehement accusations that people like David Otis Fuller and G.A. Riplinger make have polarized the church, and the devil laughs. So what is the perspective here? The perspective is, if King James only advocates would use their own arguments on the King James Version, they would discard the King James itself, because many of their arguments are dishonest and unfair. Now, some people are not intending to be dishonest. They just repeat what they've read or heard without checking the opposing view. You know, it's very important when you hear something or read something to check the person that opposes that view. And the King James only arguments have been amply refuted over and over and over. They'll say things like, well, the modern versions are based on text produced by men who had bad theology. Okay, let's try that one out. The King James Version comes from the Textus Receptus. The Textus Receptus was something that Erasmus compiled. It's not even a manuscript, but he compiled this. Erasmus was a devoted Catholic to the day of his death. He held many false doctrines, Mary worship, purgatory, the supremacy of the Pope. He was a strong opposer to the Protestant Reformation. He wanted the sanction of the Pope for his New Testament, and he received that sanction. Those are serious, serious errors. And so, any King James Version advocate that says other versions shouldn't be counted because Westcott and Hort had bad theology or whatever, then they better be honest and apply that exact same thing to Textus Receptus and apply that to Erasmus and say, well, you can't trust Erasmus, you can't trust the Textus Receptus, and you can't trust the King James. You cannot have a sword like that that doesn't cut two ways. Unfortunately, many people just foolishly listen to such arguments without checking the clear rebuttal that is readily available. Proverbs 18, verse 17 says this, the first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. You know, I believe one of the things that's worthwhile to do is have discussions with people who oppose your view. Because if you do, and if they can knock your view to pieces, they'll try to do it. And sometimes you'll find that the arguments you had, you thought were so good, aren't any good at all. Guess what? Praise the Lord, we can get rid of arguments that were false and learn something new. You know, we don't have to keep believing something that isn't true. That's a great privilege. In fact, this whole idea of only listening to one side, many people believe the false ideas that are promoted by the King James Only movement and don't realize the original translators of the King James would be opposed to the King James Only movement. The proof is, read the preface to the original King James. And in the preface, the King James translators defended their inclusion of marginal readings, clearly proving that they did not view their translation as infallible. If they viewed their translation as infallible, they wouldn't have to include something as an alternate reading in the margin. But obviously, they said, well, we're honest enough that, you know, here's one reading and here's another reading. They're letting the person know that. Sometimes when people debate this question of versions, I tell people it's more important to obey whatever version you read than to fight and condemn others and destroy brotherhood because someone reads a different version than you do. I believe that people need to be taught this major truth. You can read the version of your choice, but your choice will have consequences for yourself and for your children. But you may not divide the brotherhood because of your own preference. And I believe that people who come into churches and divide the brotherhood and make other people feel like their Bible is inspired by the devil need to be confronted and rebuked, and if they persist, they need to be dealt with. Listen to this verse from Romans that is very relevant to this kind of issue. Romans 16, verse 17 and 18. Now I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. For those who are such do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by smooth words and flattering speech deceive the hearts of the simple. And if you observe how it works, you see people doing that over and over. And when people do that, they need to be confronted with that and dealt with. If a person chooses to read the King James, that's a choice they can make. Is that the best choice to make? I don't think it's best for the person who's reading it in terms of habitually, nor for their children. Their children will grow up not understanding certain verses, but they'll be familiar with it. But if you choose to do that and you live in peace with the rest of the brotherhood who is not doing that, that's a different story. But if you make an issue of it and become divisive in the church, then you need to be dealt with. Now that brings up questions of reliability of the Bible. The Holy Spirit directed men to write, And he used their personality and background to write precisely what God wanted. Timothy says it's God-breathed. And so I believe that the Scripture is inerrant, without error, in the original autographs. In other words, when the Apostle Paul wrote it first time, it was without error. But we do not have the original writings of any biblical book. We have an abundance of ancient copies. Other ancient books, non-biblical, have only a few manuscripts. On the average, there's over 1,000 years of time space between the writings of things like Cicero and the earliest copy that we have of it. And there are only a few manuscripts. The contrast is there are thousands of manuscripts of New Testament portions. Now, God does not supernaturally prevent men from making mistakes when they copy. It's not like, let's suppose he's copying and he gets down to the bottom of a column and he starts the second column and happens to leave out a word. God doesn't supernaturally prevent him from doing that. And there's some manuscripts where you can look and you can see, he must have been copying from this particular manuscript or one like it because the word that's left out is right at the break of the column. And so you can compare copies and see which of two renderings must be correct. Maybe there's an omission of word. Maybe there's a wrong spelling. Maybe someone deliberately added something because they thought more explanation was needed. In fact, it's very interesting that there's a Greek manuscript where in the margin it says, please copy what's written instead of putting something else in there. But you know what God also did? God prevented the idolatry of worshiping the original writings by not preserving them. You see, it's possible to worship a thing rather than God. And you know, God also scattered these writings all over. You know, if somebody would burn every Bible that exists in the world, would that obliterate the New Testament? No. I mean, there are digital copies. Who knows where all they are? But in addition to that, you could take quotations from the church fathers and practically reconstruct the New Testament. In other words, there's just pieces here and there and here and there and here and there. In other words, God arranged it so no one group had complete control of the New Testament. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, there have been many people who've tried to destroy Bibles. They wanted a certain one. In fact, did you know the Muslims, they like to say, we have one Quran, it's never translated because that makes it corrupt, those kind of statements. Guess what? Hundreds of years ago, there were more than one version of the Quran, and there was a big purge where they purged out basically all but one. Now, these variations that occur in these various manuscripts do not destroy biblical doctrine. Why don't they? Because the Bible has internal redundancy which protects the truth. You know, just like when people say, oh, they took the blood out of the Bible, out of the New Testament. They did not take it all out. There's plenty of places in the NIV, which some people accuse as taking the blood out of the New Testament. There are plenty of places where the blood of Christ is explicit and clear. So what that means is there are plenty of places that the manuscripts that were used to translate the NIV didn't have it in at certain places, but it didn't mean that none of them had it in. And so it's not that these variations have destroyed the doctrine of the blood of Christ and its importance. You can study your English Bible and rejoice that it's been in your culture for hundreds of years. We have a huge advantage because of that. I mean, in most, let me give you a little statistics, and I should check about updating this. But let's say 20 years ago, it was known that there were 6,000 different languages in the world. That's not dialects, that's languages. 6,000 languages. And 4,000 of those languages did not even have one verse of Scripture. Imagine that. And we have had the Bible in our language for hundreds of years. What an advantage that has been. And another thing, some people say, well, all these versions. It's a wealth of versions that we have. Because if you read 6 different versions on a given verse, you begin to think, oh, I'm beginning to see the pattern here. I think this one over here is sort of off the track. And you begin to look at it a little more. So having more than one version to check something out is a wonderful advantage. Most people in the world do not have lots of versions. Many people do not have any. If any of you want a job, I can give you a campaign for becoming a Bible translator. Now, I know that some of you need to get up very early to go to work, and I'm not offended if you don't stay for the question and answer session, but I'm going to give time for questions. So if you feel like you need to walk out, I won't take it as an offense, but we're going to pause here for questions or observations or points that you'd like to make. Okay. Dynamic equivalence is going to say, we want to give the meaning of this verse. We're not trying to say it in exactly the same way that the verse says it. So I should have tried to find an example of that. But if you read the NIV, you'll find that various places you'll see that as compared to a literal translation. A literal translation is going to try to make it word for word where possible. But there are many places where that is not possible to have good English. For example, Greek uses something called cases. And we have only a few cases left in English. They've departed as English has evolved. For example, we have he and him. He is nominative and him is objective. See, like you say he for the subject and him for the object. Follow that? But we don't have those kind of ending changes for all the rest of the words, like, you know, cat and dog and horse and house and so on. But Greek has those. So we could say, just to make up an example, we could say in Greek, dog us ate cat um. Now you see what I'm making up there? I have a different ending for what gets eaten and what does the eating. And so that means in Greek we could say cat um eats dogus. And you see dogus is still the nominative, so that means that's the one that's still doing the action and the cat is the one that's getting eaten. But I've rearranged the word order. And Greek does that to emphasize certain things. It pulls certain things to the front, and if it pulls it to the front, then that is emphasis for that verse. That's very useful for understanding certain emphasis in a verse. But you cannot translate that literally word for word in Greek order. It would be nonsense to an English speaker. So you see, even a literal translation is not going to necessarily, it's practically impossible to do word for word. And then you have paraphrase, which is sort of like, it's not saying dynamic equivalent. It's another step away from literal. In other words, you have literal, then you have dynamic equivalent, says say the same thing in other words. And then paraphrase is just saying, well, this is my paraphrase of it. You know, I'm just going to say it however I want. And then the other one that I mentioned was dishonest translation. And I'll give you an example where I think the NIV was dishonest. 1 Corinthians 11, you're reading down through there, and it has a footnote where it's talking about a woman not being covered, then let her be shorn, and it says, or, and I can't remember the exact wording of the footnote, but or if she has short hair, she should let it grow again, as if the hairs are covering and that's all there is to it. And I knew one of the men who was on the translation committee for the NIV, helped translate the NIV, and so I talked to him and I said, you and I both know there's not a Greek text in existence that says that. And he said, well, that wasn't part of what he helped translate. Well, then why didn't you, I didn't ask him this, but you know, why didn't you raise your hand in the committee and say, wait a minute, this isn't right? Yeah, okay. Literal would be, example would be King James, New King James, New American Standard, and English Standard Version, for example. And they try to be pretty literal with the text, but you see when the way the Greek is constructed, you can't do it exactly. But still, it's pretty much trying to follow the wording of the Greek. But if you're honest with the translation, even then, you can't translate that passage in Jonah that says you're a long-nostriled God, see. But that still is a literal translation. It's just that some places you have to put it in words that mean a different thing. I mean, like, suppose the original had been written and somebody said in the original, he went out and kicked the bucket. And then somebody translated that into another language, and say in French, and said that he went out and kicked the bucket. It would be nonsense to a French person. So you have to do that. So you have literal would be King James, New King James, ESV, and New American Standard. And then paraphrase, an example of that is the Living Bible. Dynamic equivalent, an example of that would be NIV. And please notice that the NIV is, there are times it's very literal. And there are times the NIV is very good. And let me make this comment. Even though I personally do not like the NIV, I think they used liberties to the text that they should not have. But if I had only two Bibles in my pocket, one was a King James and one was an NIV, and I was ministering in a prison and somebody wanted a Bible, I would give them the NIV because it would not be as confusing And once they studied that, they would have a much clearer idea of God and how he operates. And then as they studied it some more, they might realize, you know, I think this translation is not the best in some of these places, but that comes later. It would be much easier for him to understand. And then the one I really object to as an example is Peterson's The Message. The question is, in the King James, what does it mean when it has italics? What it means, the italics are saying this is not part of the original Greek or Hebrew text. Now let me give you an example of this. Dynamic equivalent? Not necessarily. It's big, part of it is because different languages work in different ways. And so maybe in Greek, literally, it doesn't say this certain thing, but the Greek word has pieces to it that would imply that to give the explanation, so you put it in there to make it work. But turn to Psalm 19. The New King James and the King James says, verse 2, day into day utters speech, and night into night reveals knowledge. I'm reading from the New King James. And then the same on this point, verse 3, there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. And you notice, there is in italics, and where is also in italics. Does everyone see that? That's saying those things are not in the Hebrew text. And so the Hebrew would literally read, no speech nor language, their voice is not heard. And I think that is the point, and that's the way it should be translated. The heavens are declaring God's handiwork, but they're not doing it with any voice. They're not saying it in words. No speech, no language. Their voice is not heard. I mean, what, just a week or two ago, we saw a wonderful declaration of God's glory, didn't we? This total solar eclipse. You didn't see total from here, but, you know, you could go to various places, and I happened to be at a place where I could see it, and it was a wonderful gift from the Lord, that you can see that declaration of God's glory, but there were no audible words. See? No speech, no language. And so sometimes I think there's been a mistake in adding interpretive words where it would be better not to have added them. Another example of that, where I think it is not as good, is Galatians chapter 3, the latter part of the chapter. Let me find the verse. Verse 24. Therefore the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ. And to bring us is in italics. Do you see that? I think the King James probably has that. The New King James has to bring us there. I feel like that is not a good translation because it's not in the Greek text. And the Greek word that they're dealing with is a word called eis, which can mean into or to, but it can also mean until. And the context here, I believe, demands until. Because it's talking about how we were once kept under guard under the law, kept for the faith which would after be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor until Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. So you see, we're under a tutor until Christ. It doesn't say we're under a tutor to bring us to Christ. Now, it may be that this tutor was doing some bringing us to Christ. I'm not disputing that. But it's not what the text actually says. In other words, the context makes it clear that it's talking about being under this tutor until Christ came, and then the situation was drastically changed. So there are times when that has been added in that I think it is unwarranted. That's right. That's a whole other discussion. Let me tell you what the word is. In Greek, it's pedagogos. And we do not have a word in English that really fits because it's not really a tutor. It's not really what we'd call a guardian. What this person was, he was like, you see, in the Roman world, they would conquer people and make them slaves. So sometimes a person might have a highly educated person that would be a slave, and he would make that person the tutor or the trainer, or it's called the pedagogus, for his son. But the pedagogus wasn't just giving him book knowledge. The pedagogus would follow him around and make sure he did his homework, make sure he kept out of mischief, make sure he didn't do this that he shouldn't, make sure he did this that he should, and it became sort of a joke of, can I get away from my pedagogus? In other words, this pedagogus is always following me around, telling me what I can do, what I can't do, and what, make me work, and make me do my chores, make me do this, make me do that. And so that's the picture of being under the law. I mean, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, you must do this, 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 this. Every time you turn around, you might break a law, so do this and this. And then when Christ came, whew, we're not under that law anymore. See? So we don't have an English word that really fits it. And so I don't really know what the best word to put there. Translators struggle with that. But you see how when you understand the picture of what that person is, it fits with Paul's argument very much so. It's like the law was such a burden and was so restrictive. And then when Christ came, oh, what glorious freedom. Not freedom to just live as you please and live it up in ungodliness, but the freedom to actually fulfill what Christ wants with his resurrection power. Well, that might be part of it, sure. Schoolmaster, but see, that it's not broad enough yet because the schoolmaster doesn't follow the student around day and night. Yes? Okay, the question is, just like if you have a songbook, you couldn't have 15 different songbooks and we all sing out of sort of different versions of them. That's true. And you see, back at, let's say, 1810, the King James had basically gained ascendancy over all other versions, so it was practically always used. But we happen to be at a different stage in history. In other words, we're at a different stage, and so there are a multitude of English translations. In fact, there are embarrassingly many. And why are there so many English translations? It's because people recognize, well, this translation is good, but then there are certain faults with it. I think we can improve it, and so they do another one. And somebody else do another one. And so you have these different ones. That's just a fact. We have them. And so that is not going to go away. And some churches handle this by having a pew Bible. And if you have people who are non-church, that's actually quite good. Because, you know, if you say John 7:34 and somebody's unchurched, where is John 7:34? They have no idea. And so they're looking in the front of the Bible and trying to find in the contents. Maybe they don't even know where the contents are on a Bible and find John 7:34. What does 7:34 have to do with it? You know, all that kind of thing. Whereas if you have a bunch of non-church people and you have a pew Bible, you can say turn to page 622. And then in the congregation, you could just read from that Bible and everyone would have one they could follow along. That's something that some churches have done. And I can see some value in that. But obviously that requires an agreement among the congregation. Are we comfortable doing this? New Living Translation? Okay, the question, what about New Living Translation? I actually have not read much in it, but is it correct that the New Living Translation is basically a revision of what was called the Living Bible earlier? Is that correct? I just don't know. The Living Bible was a paraphrase that a fellow named Taylor, I think it was, made for his children so that they could get the basic grasp. Yes? Oh, I see. You know, I can't really comment in detail on it because I haven't studied that one. Actually, I was quoting most of the time from, well, the quotes were a lot of from the King James, but then I was reading some from the New King James. I think that what it amounts to, I'm just going to take a conjecture here, that a person who reads the New Living Translation, if that's the case of how you're describing to me, they would have a clearer understanding in general of Scripture than the person who habitually reads the King James. Because it's just, the King James is not the best available English translation today. The question is, what about the Amplified Bible? And I would say this, I do not like the Amplified Bible for this reason. You know, it'll have something, it'll come along and then have about five definitions of what it could be. That word doesn't mean all five of those things. And it doesn't mean that you can stop at that point and pick which one you like. You know, in English, for example, I caught a fly at the park. What did I do? You have no idea. Without any more context, you have no idea. But if I say, I was on first base and the guy hit a pop-up out toward right field and I caught a fly, you know I wasn't out there catching insects. But if I said, you know, I was watching this horse and he came up close and I caught a fly off of his back, you know it wasn't a softball fly. So, you see what I mean? In other words, that word fly, one case it meant fly ball, and one case it meant insect, and it's not that you can take your pick of five different definitions. And so that's why I do not like the NIV, because it almost gives people the impression that, oh, any of these, oh, it means all these things. It means any of these things. No. I said the wrong thing. Amplified, that's what I meant. Yes. That's why I don't like the Amplified, because it gives that impression. And a word in a given context means one thing, basically. Was there another question over here somewhere? You know what I believe the greatest need is? Not arguing about versions, but getting busy and studying the one you've got. That's the biggest need. A lot of people read the Bible, but they don't study it. And the more I study the Bible, the more I see there's just, like the song says, riches deep and rare. It's really wonderful.
Is that true or is that
not true? You know, the question is, there's a report that the newer ESVs are not as accurate as the earlier ones. And I don't know about that. I know that there were things that I saw in the ESV when it earlier came out that I found disturbing. And then I noticed in a later translation it was modified. It actually was made better. There was the earlier case, it was something that seemed to me had a Calvinistic bent to the translation itself. And that was disturbing. So you see, that's another thing that we're living in a very dynamic age, because you can have electronic Bible on your phone, and then they update the phone with the version that came out in, 2014, and now you've got a new one, and you hardly even notice, and oops, I thought it used to say this. So that's just something we have to live with. And it means that sometimes we have to study more on certain questions that maybe our ancestors didn't have to study on. Do you have an ESV there? Turn to Ephesians chapter 5, probably about verse 4. Let me see. Okay, it's verse 6. It's talking about, the fornicator, unclean person, covetous man who's an idolater. None of these people have inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore do not... what? Here it says in New King James is be partakers with them. What does yours say?
Associate.
Now you see, that has a different flavor. Associate almost seems to me to contradict what Paul says. You can't go out of the world. In other words, he's not saying you shouldn't associate with unbelievers, or then you'd have to go out of the world. You remember in one place? And I think partaker fits the situation here better. I'd have to look and see. Let me see what's here. Partner, okay. Is that what your ESV says?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you see, that's a little closer to be partakers with. But the Greek word is sum metokos. And so you see, it's a with something. It's sharing something. See, so don't be partakers with them. In other words, if you are a partaker with their ungodliness, you will be a partaker with the wrath that comes on such people. And so I felt like the ESV there was a little weak.